Deciphering Sitchin by Charles Henry Thomas. Narrated by Albert, a stylized Einstein-inspired character. Copyright 2026, Charles Henry Thomas. All rights reserved. This recording is protected under United States and international copyright law. No part of it may be copied, reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means. Electronic, mechanical, digital, photocopying, recording, or otherwise. Without the prior written permission of the author, except for brief quotations used in reviews or scholarly analysis. Deciphering Sitchin. An exploration of mysteries too persistent to ignore. 1. A world older than our explanations. The ancient world is not silent. It speaks through stone, through symbols, through stories that echo across continents and millennia. Yet for all our modern certainty, there remain puzzles that refuse to be filed neatly into the drawers of conventional history. These puzzles are not fringe curiosities. They are real, physical, measurable, and often unsettling in their implications. Zechariah Sitchin was not the first to notice them, nor will he be the last. But he was one of the few who insisted that the anomalies mattered. He argued that the ancient world was not merely a primitive prelude to our own, but a chapter of human history, whose sophistication we have yet to fully understand. Whether one accepts his interpretations or not, the questions he raised remain stubbornly alive. This article is not an endorsement of Sitchin's conclusions. It is an acknowledgement of the mysteries he pointed to, mysteries that continue to challenge archaeologists, engineers, linguists, and mythologists alike. The ancient world is stranger, richer, and more interconnected than we often assume. And the deeper we look, the more the ground shifts beneath our feet. 2. Sitchin's Lens. A controversial interpreter of the ancient past. Sitchin's work sits at the crossroads of archaeology, mythology, and speculative interpretation. He believed the Sumerians recorded encounters with advanced beings, the Anunnaki, who shaped early civilization. His translations of cuneiform texts have been criticized by scholars, yet his influence persists because he tapped into something undeniable. The ancient world contains patterns that do not fit comfortably within the standard narrative. He saw the gods of old not as metaphors, but as memories. He saw the myths not as allegories, but as encoded history. And he saw the symbols carved into stone not as artistic flourishes, but as remnants of a forgotten technological age. Even if one rejects his conclusions, the questions remain. Why did so many ancient cultures describe beings descending from the sky? Why do their symbols match across continents? Why do their engineering feats defy replication? Sitchin may have been wrong in his answers, but he was right to insist that the questions deserved attention. 3. The ancient world's engineering paradoxes. There are structures in the ancient world that should not exist, not because they are impossible, but because they are inexplicable within the technological limits we assign to their builders. These structures are not isolated anomalies. They form a global pattern of engineering ambition that seems out of step with the civilizations that supposedly created them. Massive stones cut with surgical precision, monuments aligned with celestial bodies to fractions of a degree, cities built on scales that defy the population estimates of their eras, and always the same motifs: the sky, the gods, the descent of knowledge from above. Mainstream archaeology offers explanations, but often these explanations feel like placeholders, theories that work on paper but collapse under the weight of the physical evidence. The ancient world was doing something we still do not fully understand, and that is where Sitchin's work, controversial as it is, finds its foothold. 4. The Hidden Architecture of Myth, Stone, and Symbol. Even if one sets aside Sitchin's interpretations entirely, the archaeological record continues to present a series of enigmas that resist easy explanation. These are not speculative fantasies. They are real engineering puzzles, symbolic patterns, and cross-cultural echoes that challenge our assumptions about the past. 4.1 Baalbek, the stones that should not exist. High in the mountains of Lebanon stands Baalbek, a site whose foundations include some of the largest stones ever quarried and moved by human hands. The trilithon blocks, each weighing between 800 and 1,000 tons, were cut with unnerving precision and raised onto a platform 20 feet above ground level. Modern cranes cannot lift them. No engineering team has replicated the feat. No ancient text explains how it was done. Sitchin saw Baalbek as a launch platform for the Anunnaki. Whether or not one accepts that interpretation, the engineering remains a riddle. Baalbek stands as a reminder that the ancient world was capable of feats we still struggle to understand. 4.2 The Wrist Device, a lifeline in an alien world. Across Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, Mesoamerica, ancient China, and the Hittite world, divine figures are depicted wearing a small round object on their wrist, a motif so consistent, so deliberate, that it refuses to be dismissed as mere ornamentation. Scholars have offered symbolic interpretations, but none explain why cultures separated by oceans and millennia rendered the same object with the same precision. If the Anunnaki were long-lived beings from a world with different atmospheric chemistry, different microbial ecosystems, and a radically different day-night cycle, then such a device would not simply be plausible, it would be essential. The wrist device may have been more than a symbol. It may have been a lifeline. The Anunnaki arriving on Earth would have faced a biological gauntlet. Our planet's oxygen levels, microbial diversity, atmospheric pressure, and rapid 24-hour rotation would have been profoundly destabilizing to a physiology evolved elsewhere. Their bodies, accustomed to the slow, stately rhythms of their home world, would have struggled to adapt to Earth's relentless tempo. Sleep cycles would be disrupted. Hormonal regulation would falter. Cellular aging might accelerate. Even the simplest bacteria could pose a threat. In that context, the wrist device becomes not a mystery, but a necessity. A constant health monitor, a stabilizer, a guardian. We already wear primitive versions of such technology. Our watches track heart rate, blood pressure, blood oxygen, sleep cycles, stress levels, and blood sugar. They warn us of arrhythmias, irregular breathing, and impending health crises. If humanity can achieve this with 21st century consumer electronics, what might a civilization tens or hundreds of thousands of years older have developed? For the Anunnaki, the wrist device may have been a continuous diagnostic system, scanning for anomalies caused by Earth's alien environment. A regulator adjusting internal rhythms to compensate for Earth's rapid day-night cycle. A microbial defense interface detecting pathogens and activating internal countermeasures. A communication node linking each individual to their group, their base, or their ship. A personal stabilizer ensuring their long-lived biology did not collapse under Earth's accelerated tempo. This would explain why the device appears everywhere they appear, why it is never absent, why it is always rendered with care, and why cultures who supposedly never met depicted it in the same way. It was not jewelry. It was survival. 4.3 The Anunnaki Purse. The bag that crossed the world. The so-called Anunnaki handbag has puzzled scholars for decades. It appears everywhere the sky beings appear, in Sumerian reliefs, Assyrian carvings, Hittite temples, Olmec monuments, and even at Göbekli Tepe. Always the same shape. Always held the same way. Always associated with divine or elite figures, too consistent to be decorative, too universal to be cultural coincidence. If the wrist device was a health monitor, a stabilizer for beings struggling to survive Earth's atmosphere, then the handbag was almost certainly its companion. A portable emergency kit, a lifeline, a field survival pack for a species out of place. The Anunnaki on Earth were not operating in a friendly environment. They were breathing air that aged them. They were exposed to microbes their immune systems had never encountered. They were working under a sun that moved too quickly, in a world whose rhythms destabilized their biology. Their wrist devices could monitor and regulate, but they could not solve every crisis. The handbag may have contained the tools that kept them alive. It may have held small canisters of Nibiru standard atmosphere, not unlike our oxygen tanks, but inverted in purpose. A few breaths of their home air could have stabilized their blood chemistry, slowed oxidative stress, or reset their internal rhythms during a biological crash. It may have carried medical compounds, antioxidative pills, immune boosters, microbial neutralizers, hormonal stabilizers, or sleep cycle regulators, the kind of biochemical support a slow cycling species would need to endure Earth's frantic pace. If the Anunnaki were involved in the construction of monumental sites, Baalbek, the pyramids, ziggurats, they would have needed portable tools. The handbag may have contained compact cutting devices, energy tools, surveying instruments, communication nodes, or emergency repair tools for their wrist monitors. And given their vulnerability, it may also have held a compact defensive device, not a sword or spear, but something subtle, technological, and easily concealed. The gods of old were not warriors in armor. They were scientists, engineers, administrators, and they needed protection. The handbag appears everywhere because the Anunnaki needed it everywhere. It was not ceremonial, it was not symbolic, it was practical. A survival kit for a world that strained their biology at every turn. Wherever the Anunnaki went, they carried the bag. Wherever humans depicted them, they included the bag. Wherever the memory of the sky beings spread, the bag followed. It was the one object the Anunnaki could never be without. 4.4 ziggurats and the architecture of ascent, a refuge for alien sleep. The ziggurat is one of the most distinctive structures of the ancient world, a massive tiered mountain of brick crowned by a single chamber at its summit. Archaeologists describe it as a temple platform, a symbolic bridge between earth and sky. But the ancient texts offer a more intimate clue. The topmost chamber was called the Ikur, or Igal, the house of the Great One. It was not a public temple, it was a residence. And one particular line from the myths has always stood out. Enlil, the senior Anunnaki, complaining bitterly that he could not sleep because the humans were too noisy. At first glance, the complaint seems trivial, almost petty. Why would a god lose sleep over human noise? Why would the activity of a few thousand people disturb a being supposedly superior to them? The answer becomes clear only when we consider the biological reality of the Anunnaki. If they came from Nibiru, a world with a vast, elongated orbit that brought it near the sun only once every 36,000 years, then their internal rhythms would have evolved under conditions utterly unlike Earth's. Their days and nights would not resemble ours. Their circadian cycles would not be measured in hours, but in weeks or even months. Their bodies required long, uninterrupted periods of deep, regenerative rest. On Earth, that was impossible. While an Anunnaki slept through what felt like a single night to them, humans would have lived through dozens of our own days and nights. We would have been awake, working, shouting, building, farming, arguing, celebrating, all while Enlil was trying to descend into the long, restorative sleep his biology demanded. From his perspective, humanity was not noisy for a few hours. We were noisy for the entire duration of his sleep cycle. His complaint was not irritation, it was exhaustion. And the solution was architectural. The ziggurat's summit chamber was not placed high above the city for symbolic reasons alone. It was a practical necessity. Elevated above the dust, the crowds, and the relentless activity of human life, the chamber provided the only environment where an Anunnaki could hope to rest. The height reduced noise, the isolation reduced disturbance. The elevation brought them closer to the sky, not for worship, but for peace. The ziggurat was a refuge, a place where beings from another world could retreat from the chaos of this one. A place where their long alien sleep cycles could unfold without interruption. A place where the rhythms of Nibiru could be preserved, even in the heart of Mesopotamia. 4.5. The Sky God Pattern, Civilizations That Never Met, Telling the Same Story. Across the world, cultures describe beings who came from the sky, taught agriculture, astronomy, and law, and departed with a promise to return. Different names, different languages, same pattern. Mainstream scholars call it convergent mythology. Sitchin called it memory. 4.6 Symbols That Should Not Match, But Do. The winged disc, the rod and ring, the pine cone, the serpent staff, the tree of life. These symbols appear globally with no known cultural contact. They are complex, specific, and often identical. How did they spread? Why did they matter? The mystery remains open. The biological shock of first contact. When beings from a slow world stepped onto a fast one. The moment the Anunnaki first set foot on Earth was not a triumphant descent of gods, it was a physiological crisis. Their bodies evolved under the long measured rhythms of Nibiru. Were suddenly thrust into an environment that moved too quickly, breathed too heavily, and teemed with microscopic life they had never encountered. What mythology later framed as the arrival of sky beings was in truth a moment of profound biological disorientation. A planet that moved too fast. On Nibiru, a single day might have stretched across weeks. Light and darkness shifted with the slow dignity of a world that took its time. Circadian cycles were not measured in hours, but in long sweeping arcs of illumination and shadow. The Anunnaki's internal clocks, hormonal, neurological, cellular, were tuned to that stately rhythm. Earth was the opposite. The sun raced across the sky, shadows stretched and collapsed in minutes. Night fell like a dropped curtain. The entire planet pulsed with a tempo that felt violent to beings accustomed to cosmic slowness. When Enki and his 50 Anunnaki landed on the shores of the Persian Gulf, they were not greeted by awe or worship. They were greeted by vertigo. They sat beneath the shade of unfamiliar trees, clutching the soil to steady themselves, watching the sun sprint toward the horizon. Their bodies rebelled, their senses misfired, their equilibrium collapsed. Earth was not welcoming, Earth was overwhelming. Atmosphere, microbes, and the invisible threat. The air itself was a shock. Earth's oxygen levels were higher than what their bodies were designed to process. The microbial density was staggering, a living fog of bacteria, spores, and organic compounds. Even the scent of the air was alien, rich, humid, saturated with life. Their wrist devices flickered with warnings, atmospheric anomalies, microbial alerts, circadian disruption. Their technology was not ornamental, it was a shield, a translator, a medical assistant working overtime to keep their bodies from spiraling into crisis. The Anunnaki were not gods immune to the world. They were travelers vulnerable to it. Sleep cycles torn apart. The greatest shock, however, was not the air or the microbes. It was time. If the Anunnaki truly lived for tens of thousands of years, their sleep cycles would have been equally elongated. They would not have slept for 8 or 12 hours like humans. They would have slept for weeks, perhaps months. Their bodies required long, uninterrupted periods of deep rest to maintain biological stability. On Earth, this was catastrophic. Humans were awake for the entirety of their night. Human noise never stopped. Human activity never paused. Enlil's famous complaint that he could not sleep because humans were too noisy was not metaphorical. It was physiological distress. His body was being denied the long rest it required to maintain stability. This is why the Anunnaki built elevated chambers atop ziggurats, not for worship, not for symbolism, for sleep. A world they were never built for. The first landing revealed a truth the Anunnaki could not ignore. Earth was not their world. Its rhythms were too fast, its air too rich, its microbes too aggressive, its inhabitants too noisy. Their bodies were not designed for this place, and every moment on Earth was a negotiation between survival and adaptation. They were not gods descending to rule. They were beings struggling to endure. The physiology of the Anunnaki. Beings shaped by a slow world, forced to survive on a fast one. The Anunnaki were not human. They were not even close. Their bodies, their rhythms, their senses, and their internal chemistry were shaped by a world that moved at a pace Earth could never match. To understand their actions, their architecture, their technology, and even their temperament, we must first understand the biology that governed them. They were long-lived, deliberate, slow-cycling beings, and Earth was a shock to their system. A species evolved under long rhythms. Nibiru, if it existed as described in ancient texts, would have been a world of elongated cycles. Its orbit, stretching tens of thousands of years, would have produced seasons that lasted centuries. Days and nights would have unfolded slowly, with light and darkness transitioning in long, gentle arcs. Life on such a world would evolve differently. The Anunnaki's physiology would have been built around slow metabolic cycles, extended hormonal rhythms, long periods of rest and regeneration, gradual shifts in energy and mood, a cellular clock that ticked at a glacial pace. Their bodies were not designed for rapid change. They were designed for endurance, longevity, and stability. Earth offered none of those things. Metabolism and longevity. Long life is not magic. It is metabolism. A species that lives tens of thousands of years must have extremely slow cellular turnover. Low metabolic heat, minimal oxidative stress, long repair cycles, deep, extended sleep phases. On Earth, this created immediate conflict. The oxygen-rich atmosphere accelerated oxidative processes. The rapid alternation of light and dark disrupted hormonal regulation. The microbial density triggered immune responses their bodies were not prepared for. Their longevity was not an advantage here, it was a liability. Respiration and atmospheric stress. Earth's atmosphere was richer in oxygen than what their bodies were adapted to. High oxygen accelerates aging, increases oxidative damage, and stresses cellular systems evolved for slower environments. Their wrist devices likely monitored blood oxygen saturation, oxidative stress markers, respiratory irregularities, microbial threats, hormonal imbalances triggered by rapid day-night cycles. These devices were not ornaments. They were medical necessities, immune system mismatch. Every world has its own microbial ecosystem. The Anunnaki's immune systems would have been adapted to the pathogens of Nibiru, not Earth. Even harmless Earth bacteria could have posed serious threats. Their technology would have compensated. Environmental filters, sterilization fields, internal immune boosters, real-time pathogen detection. This explains why they avoided large crowds of humans and why their interactions were often distant, formal, or mediated through intermediaries. Psychological adaptation, living among a fast species. Humans must have seemed frantic to them. We speak quickly. We move quickly. We age quickly. We die quickly. To the Anunnaki, human life would have appeared like time-lapse footage, a species flickering through its entire lifespan in the span of a single Anunnaki sleep cycle. This shaped their attitudes toward us: fascination, frustration, impatience, protectiveness, and at times, condescension. Not because they were gods, but because they were slow beings living among fast ones. The departure. Why the Anunnaki finally left Earth. Not because of the flood, but because Earth was aging them to death. For generations, people assumed the Anunnaki left Earth because of the flood, or because humanity became unruly, or because their mission was complete. But the ancient texts contain a detail that has always been overlooked, a detail that only makes sense when viewed through the lens of biology. When the king of Nibiru arrived after the flood, Enki and Enlil were stunned. He looked younger than they did. When the king of Nibiru arrived, he looked like their father. They looked like his elders. This was not symbolic. It was not poetic. It was not mythic exaggeration. It was biology. The Anunnaki who lived on Earth had endured centuries of accelerated oxidative stress. Our atmosphere, rich in oxygen, is a double-edged sword. It fuels life, but it also fuels aging. Oxygen corrodes, it rusts metal and it rusts flesh. It accelerates cellular turnover, damages DNA, and speeds the biological clock. To humans, this is normal. To the Anunnaki, beings evolved for a slower world, it was catastrophic. Their bodies, designed for long, slow metabolic cycles, were forced to operate in an environment that pushed them into overdrive. Every breath they took shortened their lifespan. Every day under Earth's sun strained their cells. Every disrupted sleep cycle destabilized their internal rhythms. Every hour spent in an oxygen-rich atmosphere accelerated the quiet corrosion of their biology. And by the time the king arrived, the damage was no longer theoretical. It was written on their faces, etched into their posture, visible in the way they moved. He had remained on Nibiru, preserved by the world that shaped him. They had endured Earth, and Earth had taken its toll. Author's commentary on reading Sitchin and why he still matters. Sitchin is impossible to ignore. Whether one agrees with him or not, he opened a door, a big one, for generations of readers who sensed that the ancient world held more mystery than their textbooks admitted. People don't read Sitchin because they want a perfect translation. They read him because he makes the past feel alive, charged, and full of possibility. This article exists to help readers navigate that terrain with clarity rather than confusion. To show where Sitchin was imaginative, where he was bold, where he diverged from the tablets, and why his ideas resonated so deeply with people who felt that the official story left something out. Bibliography. Core Works and Contextual Foundations. Primary Works by Zechariah Sitchin. These are the books that shaped the modern ancient astronaut conversation and form the backbone of Sitchin's reinterpretation of Mesopotamian texts. Zechariah Sitchin, The Twelfth Planet. The cornerstone of Sitchin's Earth Chronicles series, introducing the Nibiru hypothesis and his reinterpretation of Sumerian cosmology. Zechariah Sitchin, The Stairway to Heaven. A continuation of his thesis exploring ancient temples, mythic journeys, and the idea of extraterrestrial contact. Zechariah Sitchin, The Wars of Gods and Men. A dramatic retelling of ancient conflicts as literal historical events involving advanced beings. Zechariah Sitchin, The Lost Book of Enki. A narrative reconstruction written in mythic style presenting the Anunnaki story as a first-person epic.